I think we're ready to go again. It's like doing mental gymnastics. Over to you, Ellen.
But just to remind ourselves, the only reason why it's complicated is because Streeter made a mistake. Yeah? And so we have this massive thing called Q that we think we have to incorporate somehow. If we just sweep all that aside and say, what's the most obvious explanation for this data? It's because Matthew copied Luke directly. Or possibly Luke copied Matthew directly, but there are other reasons for thinking that that is unlikely. But here we were, and I was saying, why do you need Q at all? Can't we just say all the blue material is simply because Matthew is copying Luke, and there's an end to it? Well, we can't quite, because I need to turn it on. We can't quite because of passages like this. So this is Woe to the Scribes and Pharisees, an extract of it. You can see there's much less green. And actually, if you were able to see the detail of it, you see there was in different order. But it's obviously the same subject treated in a similar way, but differently. And sometimes Luke seems more primitive than Matthew. That's not a problem if Matthew's copying Luke. But sometimes Matthew seems more primitive than Luke. And that is a problem if all that's happening here is that Matthew is copying straight from Luke. Are you with me? Yeah. Earlier. Yeah. So a bed rather than a futon. So it can't be just that Matthew is copying Luke. Something more complicated looks like it's going on. And the same is true in this passage, which is going to be where our focus lies, on retaliation and on love of one's enemies. Very similar thing. They're obviously recording the same sayings, they're doing it a bit a different order and with a different vocabulary. Linda, could I ask you to sit somewhere other than in my line of sight to the screen? Thanks so much. So, but we can get a bit of help from our old friend Mark. Because there's a place where Mark is involved where we have a rather similar phenomenon. This is the parable of the mustard seed. We've got Matthew and Luke. We can tell that they're recalling the same parable, but they're using different vocabulary. Handily, we have Mark, who is telling the same parable with different vocabulary. And even more handily, the difference between Matthew and Luke is much accounted for by the contribution provided by Mark. Can you see that? If you can't, you need to sit nearer. Because this becomes quite important. You just need to be able to see colours. But where Matthew is different from Luke, it's because he's also trying to incorporate what Mark has to say. He's conflating the two together, trying to honour both versions of the parable. So maybe what's happening, I can redraw. What I'm going to do now is to redraw exactly this in a different order to help things later on. We've got Mark's version, and then Luke creates his own version. Luke tends to be flexible with his sources, creates a version with different wording, but it's obviously the same parable. And then Matthew copies Luke, but he also draws in a contribution from Mark. And that's how you get the stripy green and blue in Matthew. So maybe the same thing's happening in these retaliation and love of one's enemies. You've got the Q version is out there somewhere. And then Luke produces his own version of the sayings. And then Matthew copies Luke, but he's drawn away from Luke under the influence of the original source, and that's how you get the stripes. And that's how you can get Matthew being more primitive than Luke, even though he is copying Luke. Because the more primitive bits are the bits he's taken from Q. I got some nodding heads. You're really bright people. Guy.
So why do you have to assume that the blue bits in Matthew are not Matthew just being Matthew?
They might be.
Everything seems predicated that something has to be the source for something, rather than it being...
Yes, that's a reasonable question to ask. From what we can see of Matthew, it seems that he is not very original. So he tends to produce things which have some basis in his sources. We can't tell that because we don't have all the sources. But where he treats the source, he tends to be quite faithful to it. So it doesn't look like a creative exercise. If we can say we know that Matthew uses Luke, then we can say, well, he treats Luke in one way in this passage, copying it very exactly, but in a different way in another passage. What are the possible explanations for that? And here's a possibility. It doesn't have to be the answer. It's because Matthew wants to preserve all the tradition. He could be somebody who's living in an environment where there are lots of different versions of what Jesus did and taught, and he wants to bring them all into one handy package in neat, thematized sermons, 5 discourses. And so the reason why he's deviating from Luke's version of on retaliation and love of enemies is because he's got another version he wants to draw in.
There's also the fact that the initial Gospels were held as a verbal, passed on verbally, an oral tradition, and so that they wouldn't have actually been written down at the time of that they were being spoken or passed on.
Yes.
It's only a later date. So you could have had different people's understanding of the wording.
Yes. I'm sorry for looking around. I'm just looking for my drink, which was in a...
The bar opens in that
holder. Has anyone seen it? That's very weird. You're quite right. I'm going to slightly ignore your contribution because it just adds a level of complication which is more than we can handle in this environment. Oral tradition is out there. It's a factor. It might be that Q is an oral tradition. But the reason why Matthew was deviating from Luke is because he's heard something which is a bit similar, and he's drawing that in. But just to keep things simple, we'll treat it as if it's a written source. Okay. Allowing that option. Hey, wow, thank you very much. So, Q is necessary, according to this hypothesis, to explain alternating primitivity, which is a disputed thing. But you end up with this diagram. Now, a discipline which good scholars should engage in is identifying the problems with their theses. Well, so I quite often get asked when I'm giving a paper, or good question to ask when you're listening to someone give a paper is, what are the difficulties with your thesis? And an honest person should tell you what they are. And in this case, the biggest problem is why this happens. So, if Matthew's copying from Luke, why would he miss out all this great stuff that's in yellow? All of that yellow are things that Matthew didn't take from Luke. Why would he do that? And the answer, I think, is one of the most... It takes us to the place that's really useful about this whole discussion. The first thing to say is that when Matthew was really interested in something, like Jesus teaching on the law, he doesn't miss a scrap. So there's nothing in Luke's Gospel that Matthew overlooks that could have fitted in the Sermon on the Mount. That's just a kind of starting place. But what about the birth narratives? Matthew's birth narrative is much shorter than Luke's and doesn't include whole swathes that we do find in Luke's Gospel. Why might that be the case? It's a difficult question, and the best I can do really is to say that Matthew is trying to keep his text short. You'll find that Matthew includes more incidents than Luke, but he does so much more succinctly. He actually doesn't like story very much. You'll find there are very few stories in Matthew's Gospel compared to Luke's. He just wants to get the teaching down, move on to the next thing, gather into a group as quickly as possible, because writing materials are very expensive. So that might be one reason why he wants to condense it a lot. Another possibility is that there is another birth narrative out there that we don't know about, that includes the stories of the Magi and the Joseph point of view that Matthew includes. And that what Matthew has done is he's conflated Luke's version with this other version to create the succinct version that we have in Matthew's Gospel. And that, I think, is quite a good explanation, because there are so many things that are similar between them. They both have a genealogy. They both have visitors. They both have Bethlehem. Both have Joseph and Mary. There's actually quite a lot of similarity between those birth narratives, as well as the differences. And so that would it would make sense that Matthew is conflating two different versions. But I can't prove that, because I don't have the other version. An interesting thing which is consistently different between these two birth narratives is that Matthew always takes the opportunity to increase the dignity of Jesus. So he prefers magi to visit rather than shepherds. He prefers a genealogy which includes kings and famous people rather than lots of people we've never heard of. So we might see a process there of some kind of development. Then we get on to the body of the text, and there's a really interesting thing that happens here. You're not going to be able to, I'm going to struggle to see myself, but there's quite a consistent pattern in Matthew's omissions from Luke. So we had read for us earlier Jesus' Sermon on the Plain, which, I don't know if you noticed, is quite tough on people who have money. Did you spot that? Matthew's version has, "Blessed are the poor in spirit," which we much prefer. We tend to use it a lot more. Luke's has, "Blessed are the poor," full stop, and "Woe to the rich," full stop. And you can see how Matthew actually is very reluctant ever to condemn. He doesn't ever condemn somebody or allow Jesus to condemn somebody just because they are rich. And so where Luke is particularly challenging about money in that way, he omits it. So he leaves out the woes. Well, Luke's Gospel is famous for being very positive about women, including women in all sorts of situations and roles that aren't standard in Jewish society. The raising of the widow's son is curious because Jesus makes his way to the widow, which is not the kind of interaction you'd expect in first century Palestine. Matthew omits every occasion where a woman behaves in a way which is not conventional to Jewish practice. Jesus' testimony to the Baptist is also about money. The anointing of the house of the Pharisee is the woman anointing the feet of Jesus. The ministering women, they're also women. They get left out. Matthew doesn't like Samaritans being put in a good light either. Hospitable Samaritans get omitted. The good Samaritan gets omitted. Mary and Martha are women. The mother of Jesus is a woman. Sometimes God is portrayed in a way which might not go down very well with your traditional Jewish male. Sometimes he's just really odd. The parable of the coin, God is portrayed as a woman who sweeps a room to find the coin. The prodigal son has a thing, it has instant righteousness, which also Matthew doesn't like. You're not allowed to get saved just by saying, "Please forgive me," in Matthew's gospel. You have to be law observant, actually. Prodigal son gets left out. Is also a long story. The unjust steward portrays God in a rather curious light. It's a very odd parable anyway. I think if you were writing a combined gospel, you might miss it out. The rich man and Lazarus condemns the rich man for being rich. The healing of the 10 lepers, the one who comes back, is a Samaritan. God is portrayed as a godless judge. The Pharisee and the publican is given instant righteousness. Zacchaeus achieves instant righteousness. And the thief on the cross achieves instant righteousness. It doesn't occur in Matthew's gospel. And then we come to the passion narrative. And here we hit what might just be a practical problem. Luke's Passion narrative is set in Jerusalem. The resurrection appearance is in Jerusalem. Matthew's and Mark's are set in Galilee. So if you're trying to meld these two together, you get into a terrible twist. And actually, when Tatian attempts to do that, when Tatian creates his combination, his harmony of the Gospels, what he does at this point is he does give up and he puts them in series rather than trying to knit them together. And you can also imagine it's very, very hard work creating a harmony. And you can imagine that if you come and look at this diagram afterwards, you can see that Matthew changes the order of Mark and Luke a lot at the start, and then he gradually gets more and more regular. You think, just running out of puff at this point. We'll stick with Mark, get to the end of the story. All speculation, but that's a possible explanation. And it does do something interesting. If it's right, if those reasons for omitting what Luke has are right in the middle sections, that tells us something very interesting, doesn't it? There is a tendency among scholars to say, well, the parable of the Good Samaritan is probably a Lucan creation because it doesn't occur anywhere else. But actually, it might be more faithful to the teaching of Jesus than we allow, because it's the kind of thing that the later church found rather hard. Jesus' attitude to women, well, that's just because Luke really liked women. It might be because that's what institutions tend to do as they develop, to cut women out. And that's what Matthew does in his treatment of Luke. And so maybe Luke's portrayal of Jesus' attitude to women is more faithful. It's not to say Jesus is a conventional feminist in the 21st century sense, but he has a stronger feeling for women than Matthew would allow by a very long way. And I think that the Mary Magdalene film that's out at the moment, I suspect that has a grain of truth in it. It seems quite credible that Mary Magdalene would have had a much more prominent place in the early church than she is allowed in the Gospels. That's what's another thing that Dan Brown might have got right. So this could be a case of where a puzzle leads to an insight. We don't necessarily have to be down on Matthew. It may be that Matthew's situation was one where he was addressing rich male Pharisees. And he just knew that those stories in Luke's Gospel weren't going to cut it with that audience. And so he left them out. Doesn't mean to say he's misogynistic. He might have been, but it's not. We don't have to tar him with that. He's not necessarily writing for a completely general audience. He's writing for a particular reason. Something has provoked him to write, to do the great work of writing a gospel. It's a really, really difficult thing to do. And it's probably something to do about the debate with ongoing Judaism, disputing that Jesus is really Messiah. So when you're debating with men who are only going to be persuaded by a particular kind of argument, or who would be instantly put off by another kind of argument, you leave those out and we're left with a legacy. I can see the time running away, and that's not great. You do want to know what Q is, don't you?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Feel free to keep asking questions, but I will try and keep it moving now. So, here's the diagram. Q has changed out of all proportions. Previously, it was this monster of 4,500 words. And now it's kind of bits and bobs, which just happen to have been used by Matthew and Luke. And that means an interesting thing happens. Because Q changes, we might find that rather than having to reconstruct it on the basis of similarities between Matthew and Luke, it could be that Q is hiding in a library somewhere near you. And in order to find that, what we need is to look for texts of a particular type. The best place to look will be not in the places where Matthew and Luke agree exactly, which is where the Q scholars have been most confident in their reconstruction of Q. That's not the place to look, because that's just Matthew copying Luke. The place to look is where Matthew is being drawn away from Luke under the influence of something else. Passages like Woes to the Scribes and Pharisees, and on retaliation and love, and on love of one's enemies. So we're looking for an early Christian text which has things which are a bit like this, but not exactly like this. Love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who abuse you, and Matthew's version of that. If anyone strikes you on the cheek, offer the other also. And from anyone who takes away your coat, do not withhold even your shirt. And Matthew's version of that. Give to everyone who begs from you. And if anyone takes away your goods, do not ask for them again. And Matthew's version of that. And amazingly, there's a little first century text that has got those types of sayings in it. It's the world-famous Didache that you are so much better informed about than any other group of Christians in the land. Yeah, have you got your copy somewhere at home? Yeah, please, I'd like the copies you have here back. If you would like to buy one from me, I will charge you an exorbitant sum. Okay, so you are welcome to buy one off me, but I'd rather have them back. Just so you can look at them today. So the Didache was discovered in a library in Constantinople in 1873, and it includes these sayings. The Didache is the teaching of the Lord by the 12 apostles to the Gentiles. It's a very mysterious little text that includes what you need to do to get baptized, what you need to do to share the Eucharist, how to manage visitors, a bit of church order, and a final eschatological warning. It's a very practical text which scholars date between about 50 and 150. I think it's most of it is very early. But the thing which is interesting for our purposes now is that it has these sayings in it. Prepare to be amazed. Well, that's not so amazing. Yeah, here it comes. So the Didache has, in its first chapter, if someone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also, and you will be perfect. If someone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. If someone takes your cloak, give him your tunic also. That's very reminiscent of those other sayings we were looking at, isn't it? But they're in a different order, and they're slightly different wording. If someone takes from you what belongs to you, do not demand it back, for you cannot. Give to everyone who begs from you, and do not demand it back. Very similar to what we have in Matthew and Luke, but slightly different. Do you remember what happened in the parable of the mustard seed? Mark accounted for the difference between Luke and Matthew. Yeah? So the $6 million question, Jeff, is can the Didache performed the same trick. So here we had Mark's version. Again, you need to come near so you can see the colours. Goes to Luke's version in green, and then Matthew's version of Luke deviates from Luke under the influence of Mark. Can you see that? If you can't see it, come and sit on the front row. Seriously. Because this is all you're getting. I don't have another means of making the argument. So here we have on retaliation. That's the Didache's version. That's Luke's version. Same idea, slightly different wording. Luke tends to stretch and reshape his sources more than Matthew does. Matthew's version of Luke, a copy from Luke, deviates from Luke. Is it under the influence of the Didache? 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Wow. That's so clear. It does. And actually, if you reduce the number of times that Matthew has to switch between Matthew, Luke, and the Didache, you get that. Can you see? Orange, green, orange, green. Just like we had with Mark. Here's love of enemies. There's Didache's orange version, there's Luke's green version. Matthew copies from Luke. Is he drawn away from Luke under the influence of the Didache? Well, yes, he is. To a very remarkable extent. Green, orange, green, orange, green, orange. Be perfect. Luke has, be merciful as your Father in heaven is merciful, as your Father is merciful. Luke has be perfect. Oh, Didache has be perfect. And Matthew has be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. The golden rule. The Didache has do not do to others as you would not have them do to you. Luke presents that in a positive form, slightly different wording. Matthew has it in a positive form, but he has words that Luke doesn't have. Where did they come from? Did they come from the Didache? Yeah, some of them do. And so we have this triangle which puts some source as accounting for the occasions when Matthew deviates from Luke. And an example of that is Didache 1, 2 to 5, which you have a copy of at the moment. Now, in the history of Didache scholarship, the Didache was discovered by a man called Bryennios, and it's always been regarded as an important text, but one which is kind of secondary to the Gospels, outside that circle there. But if Didache 1, 2 to 5 was used by Matthew and Luke, then it's the original version of that Didache, because Didache developed through time, the earliest version of it becomes pretty close to the origins of the Jesus movement, doesn't it? And it becomes quite an important and interesting text, which raises a few questions. What is the original Didache? Which part's the original? Who wrote it? When did they do so and why? And most of you have a thing which says that it's the apostolic decree, which is the letter that James and the apostles wrote to the Gentiles in Antioch in 48 AD, which would make it the earliest text we have, earliest Christian text we have. The common point that joins all the strands of Christianity that grow from that early period. It's a very, very important text. We've got 10 minutes for questions. On my website, which is alangarra.com, you will find the full versions of these talks, which are really designed for undergraduate students and scholars, but I did try to make them as simple as I can. So if you'd like to revisit this stuff or look at it in a bit more detail, then that's the place to go. Thanks, Dave.
Okay, we'll start the questions just here.
So was there a Berlin Wall between Q, or Didache, and Mark? Or did Mark read the Didache?
Oh, did Mark know the Didache? There's just one little fractional suggestion of that, but I think the broad answer is no. There's nothing in Mark to suggest he was dependent on the Didache. But the thing about Mark's gospel is a quite good reason for thinking it's the reminiscences of Peter, in which case your source material is all in one place. You're not going around trying to collect it from lots of different places.
Thinking of the resurrection narratives, Mark doesn't have one. Matthew's is less physical. Luke's is more physical. In fact, Luke's is so physical that he has then the separate ascension. If Matthew copied Luke, this progression of a more physical resurrection, that doesn't fit with the idea that Matthew copied Luke, does it?
Yes, so that's going back to the question, why would you miss out that good stuff at the bottom? And I gave you my best shot at that. I think that Matthew's version of Mark's resurrection narrative is much fuller than Mark's, isn't it? So that you'd see progression in that respect. But does Matthew take advantage of what Luke says about Jesus' physicality? No, he doesn't. So that would be a weakness in the theory.
Matthew has the resurrection and the ascension as the same thing. Uh-huh. Luke separates them, doesn't he?
Yeah.
So if Matthew copied Luke, he's not copying that bit, is he?
He's not copying that bit. I think that's really true.
Okay.
I think he's copying Mark and he's drawing in the Judas, the traditions and other bits and bobs, but he's essentially saying, I can't cope with Luke at this point. Might be he doesn't like him, or maybe it's just too difficult because of the geographical differences. But good question, thank you.
But Luke
There's a question.
Yeah, sort of different question here. Thinking about differences between different accounts of the same things. Yeah. If there's one thing that's pretty definite about New Testament scholarship, it's that Acts was written by Luke.
Yes. Well, whoever wrote Luke.
Yeah. Yes. Maybe it was someone else with the same name, as they say. Yeah. But if you read the account of the Ascension in Luke and Acts, they are subtly different. Yeah. Do scholars consider those differences and think about why he wrote one thing in one place and a slightly different thing in another? And does that illuminate how maybe people copying from each other also made differences?
I really don't, that's a very interesting question, and I don't know the answer to it.
About 40 years ago, I read a book by John Robinson called Can We Trust the New Testament? Yeah. It put a bomb under all the stuff that I'd learned at university and loads of stuff, academic scholarship on the New Testament, just about approaching the text directly and seeing, not in a naive way, but in a post-naive way, saying that's great, the scholarship, and I'll study it, and I'll look at it, and I'll consider the latest theories, but actually see what God's saying to me now through this text. Yes. And that was just so helpful, especially as John Robinson had actually been one of the contributors to my thinking about Q and all the other gospel writers. And that's what I've lived with in ministry since. And I'm really grateful to it for that little book. And he's buried in our diocese, by the way.
Right. Is he? Well, thank you very much for bringing us back to where I was hoping we began from. But there are limits to what scholarship can contribute. Because it's contingent, it's often wrong, and it doesn't cover everything. And following Jesus is about our relationship with Jesus. And we hope the scholars do a good job of telling us a few things that are true or less untrue than we might previously have thought.
Yeah. Hi, I think in a way this follows onto what you've just said. Okay. But it strikes me when you look at the differences between Luke and Matthew that actually the Luke bits are the bits that are particularly popular in modern preaching.
Yeah.
And I just wonder if you could argue that, in fact, we've got the wrong emphasis in modern Christian faith.
I think we've got the right emphasis, personally. I think it's a bit of luck that we like Luke so much more than Matthew and Mark. But where this leads for me is that Luke is a distinctive witness because he's got his own distinctive audience. If he's trying to help the Gentile world to get to grips with Jesus, then he's addressing people like us, or closer to people like us than the other Gospels are. But we can't know how close he is to what Jesus really taught. But I think he's closer than Matthew, for what that's worth. But at the same time, Matthew's great gift to us is he recovers old traditions like what we find in the Didache and preserves them for us because he's tried to hold everything together. So you can't just say, well, Matthew is late and therefore a load of rubbish. Matthew is holding something which is also valuable, both in its antiquity and in showing us the full picture. Something that rabbis do when Jewish tradition puts different opinions from different rabbis together, and they might be quite contradictory. And he says, well, go and work out the difference. And you find that in the Sermon on the Mount, actually. Pearls before swine and ask, seek, knock. Is that little section there, it looks like these things don't fit together. How are you supposed to not judge, and yet say the people are swine? Well, it's complicated, isn't it? Real life.
Any more? It's almost 12. Maybe one more question, if there is. Yes.
Oh, sorry. I don't know which is first.
No. What evidence is there about when the Didache was written?
That's the book I'm writing at the moment. So if you're asking me, if we had all the Didache scholars in the world, which would not be a very long line, then I think most of the specialists these days would say it was written between about 50 and 80. Certainly first century. There are those who put it later than that, but their star is waning at the moment. The scholarship does tend to go in waves and fashions. So you can't, with these things, it's really difficult to tell. I want to, the book I'm writing at the moment is trying to demonstrate that the first version of the Didache, the teaching of the Lord by the 12 apostles to the Gentiles, was the letter that James and the apostles wrote to the Gentiles in Antioch, in which case we can date it with more accuracy than virtually any other letter in the New Testament. 48 CE, that's it, on the button. You can already probably even pick the month. When are the other bits added? That's much harder to say. And one of the bits that is added, I think, is added with knowledge of Matthew's gospel. So that puts all kinds of cats among the pigeons, because it means it's very, you can't say, what's the date of the Didache? It's what's the dates of the Didache. It's quite complicated.
I think the fact that there are so many variations that you've shown us in your colour-coded actually is an argument for their veracity. If God had wanted to, he could have had it all written down in one place and somebody would have found it and said, this is what Jesus said. The fact that it varies, to me, makes it far more likely that what is said is probably about right. And the nitpicking that goes on is really just for scholars, because most of us probably are quite happy with the versions we've got. And as I said, Luke is very popular. Is there anything in any of these versions that directly contradicts each other in a negative way that we'd say, oh, that's obviously wrong?
You're completely right, Stella. I think that sense of... this is very much a case of, well, I came into this thing not knowing about Q, and now I learn about Q, and I know I don't need to know about Q. Well, well done, everybody. You started, you know, where you started was fine. And that sense of there's nothing contradictory. The sense of what Jesus taught is consistent in all of them. There are slight variations. I think the only thing which was a challenge for me in this journey is I think there is a bit of a tendency in the tradition to just tone down the radicality of Jesus' teaching a bit in relation to women and poverty. And I think that you can see exactly why. If you were copying out a version of, you know, the Didache says, if someone asks something from you, you have to give it and not ask for it back. Which then means that someone else adds, if they ask without need, they could get thrown into prison until they pay out the last penny. You can see a development in the tradition there, because you've got to live with the practicality of trying to live by these rules. And you can see how when Luke or Matthew take that saying, it gets changed to, if someone wants to borrow from you, you must allow them to borrow from you. Yeah? This makes it a bit more palatable. But Jesus is actually amazingly hard-edged. Blessed are the poor. Woe to the rich. It was as straightforward as that.
Well, we've been blessed today, I think. A big round of applause to say thank you to Alan for all his work.